This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices episode 180 was recorded on August 15th, 2019. I'm Eric Townsend. This episode of Macro Voices is brought to you by Top Traders Unplugged.com, the only podcast dedicated to quant and rules-based investing, which I highly recommend. Professor and fund manager Daniel LaCaille is back as this week's feature interview guest, and we'll have a detailed discussion of monetary policy, including what the political popularity of modern monetary theory will mean for markets, and why Professor LaCaille thinks the bond market has it right, but the S&P 500 has been slow to get the proverbial memo. Be sure to stay tuned for our post-game segment after the feature interview, when Patrick and I will discuss risk in the triple B and junk bond markets. As Macro Voices junkies remember, Louis Vincent Gav told us months ago that the whale in the triple B bond market was General Electric. Now, do you remember the name Harry Markopoulos? He was the whistleblower who exposed Bernie Madoff's frauds to the SEC. Well, guess who he just accused of massive accounting fraud on the scale of Enron? That's right, GE. Unfortunately, Louis Vincent Gav couldn't join us on short notice for our postgame segment, but Patrick and I will discuss whether a GE credit downgrade could be the catalyst to bring on a long-awaited dislocation in the triple B and junk credit markets. We also have a fantastic summer special planned for you, which will air during the final 2 weeks of August. And those of you who enjoyed our Dollar Endgame series at the end of 2017 are really going to love it. We'll tell you more about what to expect right after the market wrap.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Now, Eric, let's jump into this S&P 500 because it continues to deteriorate on the bottom end. Do you think the selling is going to continue here?
You know, I'm really starting to think so. And let's just review the recent history. You know, we were flirting around with all-time highs. There was the Fed panic, which retraced very quickly. Then came President Trump's tweet essentially restarting a trade war with China. That resulted in a much bigger dump, and it started to retrace. But then, as I've been saying, the big risk, the reason I was hesitant to short this market is because I thought, you know, any day now, President Trump could come out and say, hey, he's kissed and made up with China, and it's really all going to be better, and they're going to make a deal after all. Well, that sort of kind of happened this week. We didn't get a complete reversal, but President Trump said that he wanted to negotiate with China and that he was delaying the imposition of tariffs. So it was a pretty strong signal that in the past, it wouldn't have surprised me at all if that had taken us to new all-time highs. But it didn't. In fact, the instantaneous spike up in equity prices, which was to be expected and unavoidable, only lasted for 24 hours before we were trading at a new lower number, below the number where the news first came out. I think this is really significant because what's happened in the past is as soon as there have been signs that trade war with China is not really happening, we've seen a moonshot back to new all-time highs. This time, the bounce didn't even last 24 hours. So maybe finally, reality is set in. And I do think economic reality calls for much lower stock prices. The bond market gets it, clearly, but the stock market's been slow to take the memo, as you're going to hear from Professor Daniel LaCaille in today's feature interview. So I think maybe, Patrick, we're finally getting to the point where gravity is setting in, reality is taking hold. And I think there's lots of room for a whole lot more downside. Let's save the rest of that conversation, though, for the post-game segment, because I know you've got some charts prepared, and I'm particularly keen to get your perspective on the technical levels that we need to watch.
Well, for sure. We'll do that in the post game. So let's move on to the U.S. dollar index, because obviously we had the other week a sell-off that was after breaking to a higher high. But now the dollar is back up toward 98. Was that just a little blip? Is the dollar going to resume its uptrend again?
Well, I think it is, Patrick, but we're definitely at make or break time for the U.S. dollar here. We were breaking out past that critical level of 98. It looked to me like things were really breaking out. Then we had the Trump tweet and the trade war and so forth. And it was unavoidable that there would be a very significant knee-jerk lower on the dollar. You know, the president of the United States starts a currency war. That's kind of negative for the currency. That took us right back down to about 97 even, and now we're rallying pretty hard for the last couple of days off of that. This is the rally that is going to make or break this. In other words, if we can get a daily close above the previous high, which was about 98 spot 60 something, let's call it 98.70 or so, if we can get a daily close above that number, it really confirms this was not a false breakout, that the move is on. We just had a news-induced pullback, and things still look good for the dollar. That's my base case. That's what I'm betting on. That's what I think is happening here. We do need to be fair, though, and say, look, from a technical analysis standpoint, if we were to see a failed rally here, we're right at 98 as we're speaking on Thursday afternoon. If it stops here and then we go the other direction and see a daily close below 97, these numbers are all on the September futures contract. If we were to see that, I'd really have to say, boy, it doesn't jibe with my fundamental view, but that would be a technical signal that would tend to confirm that this was a false breakout and would signal much lower numbers to come. I don't think we're going there. I think we're going north, and I think that once we clear 98.75, let's say, with a couple of days of daily closes above that, I think it's going to be an acceleration to the upside and 104 comes into sight. But let's not put the cart before the horse. Right now, we got to clear 98.60.
Eric, let's talk crude oil. It's been very choppy the last couple weeks, but the trend seems generally downwards. I mean, is there more downside? And also, how did the inventory numbers come in?
I think that there is more downside, and because today was an option expiration day, we were pinned between some of the option expiration strikes. I won't be at all surprised now if I look at RBOB gasoline as a signal that tends to be an early warning sign for crude oil. It's well below all three of its short-term moving averages. Crude is still locked in between its short-term moving averages. I think that's about to change to the downside. But let's start with EIA inventory. Crude oil, surprise build this week again of 1.6 million barrels. Cushing, Oklahoma, though, drawing down 2.5 million barrels, and it looks like that could be a continuing trend. Genscape, the private data service that reported this morning, is anticipating potentially another 2 million barrels next week. So Cushing, Oklahoma, that's the tank farm that's landlocked in Cushing, Oklahoma, is seeing drawdowns even in the face of nationwide builds. Finished products also drawing down this week, gasoline down 1.4 million barrels, distillates down 1.9 million barrels. Now, even before the inventory data had come out, it was already a very big down day, and that just accelerated on that unexpected crude oil build. And we saw the tape action go profoundly down. U.S. production, 12.3 million barrels, unchanged, still holding firm there at just about 100,000 barrels under the all-time record. Imports up to 7.7 million barrels per day. Exports back up to 2.7 million barrels per day after being depressed last week. Options expiration day is today. As I say, I think that has been what has kept WTI crude oil pinned in a fairly narrow range. But as I look at RBOB gasoline, it gave up its 8-day moving average after yesterday giving up its 5-day moving average and 3 days ago failing to break out through its 13-day moving average. So if RBOB is an early warning sign for where crude is headed, which I think it oftentimes is, that means that maybe lower numbers are in the cards. But we'll see what happens.
All right, well, let's move on to gold, because after 3 up days in the dollar index, my first impulse would have been that this would have softened gold prices, but they don't seem to want to back off their highs. I mean, does gold still have more to go? What's your take on all of this?
Well, I certainly agree with you on that. I was expecting, as the dollar started to break up again, that it would be at least a headwind for gold. And we did see that, you know, when the news came out that the tariff extension had occurred, there was an instantaneous drop in gold back down to 1,500. Can you believe that? We're saying back down to 1,500. Just a few weeks ago, we were saying up to 1,350. So, you know, it seemed like that signal that I expected to be bearish for gold was going to take effect. That only lasted a day or so. And I think we haven't quite taken out the previous high, but we're working our way back up to it. So I think that we have gone a little bit too far too fast. Clearly, I was wrong with respect to thinking that the dollar was going to be a headwind for gold that might take us to much lower numbers, say below 1,200. That didn't happen, and you can't be right all of the time. But believe it or not, Patrick, what I bought today was puts on long-dated gold futures. And I know that's going to sound to our listeners like, oh boy, there he goes again, thinking the price of gold's going to crash. No, I don't think it's going to crash. I think that I missed the call. I admit that. It's time to figure out how to be long gold here. But I think it's moved too far too fast, almost $200 up in 2 months. And I really think that there's likely to be a pullback at some point. The reason that I'm buying long-dated puts on gold is a strategy that I've used before that I really like. It's called legging into a synthetic call. And the idea is, if we do get a move back down to, let's say, 1380, I really want to buy gold and buy a lot of it there, because I think that if we get that retest of the breakout zone, it's time to buy. Well, the thing is, what if my original view from way back actually turned out to be right after all, and there is a big move down in gold? I want to be able to buy at 1380 with a little bit of leverage. Well, in order to do that, you need some kind of hedge. Buying that hedge right here, right now, while gold prices are still high, is cheap. So I'm buying the put that's going to allow me to use more leverage to buy more gold at 1380 and not worry about the downside, because I'll be fully hedged when I make that call. Now, needless to say, gold could go straight up from here, in which case the options that I bought will expire worthless, and you know, so it goes. It was a small premium, less than $9 for 1350 puts on the June of 2020 contract, and that sets me up to leg into a synthetic call on gold with leverage if we get back down to 1380. Don't know when that's going to happen, but I won't be surprised if it happens before this is over.
All right, well, let's move on to the 10-year Treasury yield, because we dropped below 1.50 today. Like, this thing is just nosediving. When does this stop, Eric?
Well, you know, we used to talk on this program about, you know, do you think that we'll ever get back to that all-time low of 1.36 on the 10-year? Now the question is, are we going to get there by the time that our listeners hear this program, in the next 4 hours? I mean, it's crazy how it's going. Needless to say, I do think that the argument is in place. I think the bond market is telling us that a recession is coming. Why the stock market is staying as high as it is a mystery still. Maybe that won't last much longer. I'm certainly going to talk to Professor Lacaille about that in today's interview. But yeah, I wish that when I was waiting for a pullback to get to 220, I had just bought 210. At this point, I feel like it has gone too much too fast. I'm not going to jump into the long side of this trade here. But the macro signal here is that we're headed for trouble in the economy. But Patrick, the point I really want to make about fixed income, we're going to have to save for the post-game segment, and that's actually the scenario that you called to my attention this morning with what's going on with GE as potentially being a whale, in not in the junk market, but in the triple B market. That could have knock-on effects and consequences. Let's save that conversation for post-game.
And before we move on to the feature interview, we need to announce our summer special on the future of monetary policy. But and also, you got a couple videos you're about to release this weekend. So why don't you let all our listeners know what to expect?
Well, let's start with the summer special. Our production staff has been doing an absolutely fantastic job with all of our expanded content. They deserve a well-earned holiday, just like everyone else. So we're going to take a little break for the second half of August here. There won't be any Energy Week shows for the next 2 weeks. And for Macro Voices, we've got something really exciting planned for you. Those of you who really enjoyed our end of the year special in 2017, which was called the U.S. Dollar Endgame, have been emailing us asking for similar content next time we do a holiday special. Well, you've got it. We've got Danielle DiMartino Booth and Peter Bookvar joining us for the next 2 weeks. the format of the next couple of weeks' shows. We're not going to have a market wrap unless there's extraordinary market conditions that dictate we have to have one. And the way things are going, that's entirely possible. But what we are going to do is dedicate the entire show to a long-form interview, which will run over the course of 2 weeks. I will be joining Danielle and Peter as panelists, and you, Patrick Ceresna, will be the MC and moderator for the overall event. It's already been taped. It was a fantastic session that we had, and I think you're really going to enjoy it. Now, if something really crazy happens in the markets, we'll change our plans and come back and try to give you some kind of market wrap or commentary. But barring outright catastrophe, we don't expect to tape a regular show again until September 5th, when we'll be back with our regular format. As far as videos, Patrick, we're going to continue to produce most of our podcast content as audio only. It just doesn't make sense to produce it as video podcasts. The production cost isn't justified for that. But for longer shelf life content, we're going to start introducing a series of advanced investor education videos. The first one explains how to trade hedge fund strategies like long short equity in your own account. We're really excited about this, and it's going to be a video series that will be available on macrovoices.com free of charge and supported by donations. So we've got videos coming, but before we even get to that advanced series, I've got two that will be released hopefully in the next couple of days here, certainly by the end of the weekend. Those are an update on the digital currency revolution, and I really want to encourage everyone in the audience to check them out. I know a lot of our listeners are not interested in Bitcoin and cryptocurrency. Look, that's not what this is about. It's really more about what comes next after cryptocurrency and why digital currency, not cryptocurrency, but other forms of digital currency are eventually going to completely change the shape of the international monetary system. So I really encourage you to check those videos out. What you'll be getting on your iTunes feed will just be a 2-minute trailer, and then the full-length videos are available at macrovoices.com/video. They're not up yet, but they should be before the weekend is out.
Okay, thanks for the update. Now, this week's featured interview guest is Professor Daniel Lacaille. Now, Eric, why did we invite Professor Lacaille to return as our featured guest this week?
Well, listening to some old interviews, you know, he's one of the guys who has been saying for a long time that the stock market is not getting it, that we need lower prices. But he was also very prescient in saying, don't expect a crash to start tomorrow. He expected us to get back to all-time highs exactly as has happened. So the forecast that he gave us last time he was on the show has been remarkably prescient and very accurate. So we'll find out what he's now expecting in the stock market, but clearly we've got a disconnect. Bonds and stocks don't agree. Somebody needs to be proven right. We're going to cover that and a whole bunch of other exciting topics. This episode of Macro Voices was made possible by TopTradersOnPlug.com. You'll often hear me say on the program that even if I have strong conviction about a market or a trade, that you have to listen to what the market is telling you, not what you think it should be doing. And that's exactly what trend following managers have been doing for decades with great success. These are rules-based strategies that remove human emotions and therefore can be well-researched and tested. And there's one podcast that covers trend-following strategies better than any other, TopTradersOnPlugged.com. And right now, Macro Voices listeners can even get a free book called The Many Flavors of Trend Following, explaining exactly how these systematic strategies can work for you. Just go to toptradersonplug.com/macro to claim your free copy. Again, that's toptradersonplug.com/macro. Check them out. You'll be glad you did.
Now, Eric's interview with Daniel is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now, with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is Professor Daniel Lacaille, professor of global economics and both chief economist and fund manager for Tresis. Professor Lacaille, the last time that we had you on the program, I encourage our listeners to go back and listen to that interview. I think you anticipated and correctly predicted a lot of the things that are happening today. But clearly, we need to start with this trade war slash currency war, potentially. What do you make of this situation? Is President Trump just showing us a few of those art of the deal negotiating tactics, or is he serious about starting what could become a very serious and ongoing currency war with China?
Hi, thank you very much for having me on the show. Well, the first thing I would say is that President Trump is definitely using a negotiation tactic, and it's clearly a negotiation tactic with a very clear objective as well. When President Trump started what the so-called trade war, all the tariffs, etc., the idea was that China, in the last basically 8 to 10 years, has been increasing dramatically its presence in the global economy, yet at the same time, it hasn't opened the economy as much as it should have. So therefore, all of the different claims that the World Trade Organization, that the United States made against China, etc., were not working. The objective behind the tariffs was obviously to get China to understand that their position was a position of weakness, and that this was a negotiation between the largest supplier, China, with the largest customer, the United States. And as in business, the customer is the one who dictates the terms, not the supplier. In that sense, tariffs were sort of implemented as a weapon to get China to accelerate the opening of its economy. Unfortunately, what we have seen is that, as in previous occasions, as we saw as well with George W. Bush and the tariffs on aluminum, as we saw with President Obama and the tariffs on solar panels, is that tariffs tend to be used as an excuse for increasing protectionism, not as a way of improving the economy for the country that suffers those tariffs. And unfortunately, that is what we have seen, is that the position of China has been of nice words, say that they're open to negotiations, that they're open to dialogue, etc., at the same time arriving nowhere. And in the meantime, and this is critical, implementing further and more aggressive capital controls in the domestic economy. And I think it was this, the increase in capital controls and the increase intervention in the financial system, that triggered the next and final wave of more aggressive messages from the United States, because it showed as a red flag of what was actually really behind China's intentions, which was not to open the economy, let alone to reach an agreement, but to protect itself as much as possible and actually implement a currency war.
Professor Lacaille, it sounds like you and I are in very strong agreement that President Trump's intention here was not to start a currency war, but rather to use a negotiating tactic to try to assert his position of power in a negotiation designed to result in some kind of deal. But some people have opined that perhaps President Trump has started a fire that he won't be able to put out, that what this could result in is other central banks around the world saying, okay, looks like game on for competitive devaluation, and potentially everybody jumps into easing mode, and you get into a situation that you can't get back out of. Is there a risk of that?
There is a risk. However, I think that it's a moderate risk right now. The reason being the following. I think that what we have seen from the latest devaluation of the yuan, but also from the previous ones that we saw in 2016, also in 2018, is that the impact on the global economy and on global financial assets is much larger than what the central planners anticipate. And also, from the experience of previous misnamed competitive devaluations, we also know that policymakers are pretty aware that competitive devaluations have very little effect, very little positive effect on the economy. Rather, what they tend to do is to create a sense of concern from consumers, from investors. So decisions of consumption and investments tend to be stopped or postponed because of those competitive devaluations. In fact, a competitive devaluation, first, is not a competitive, doesn't improve competitiveness. But second, and more importantly, it is the equivalent of a salary cut and a wage cut in the economy. So as the global economy, and particularly the central banks that are more aggressive in terms of monetary policy, are in economies that are mostly service-oriented, they know that what we are already seeing, which is a recession in manufacturing, could trigger a recession in the service industry if you just destroy the purchasing power of currencies via artificial depreciation.
Let's move on to financial markets then. Something that I've been feeling, and I think it very much echoes some of the sentiment that you described in the last interview that we did with you several months ago. As I look at the various different markets, it seems like the bond market is telling me we've got a problem here. We're looking at collapsing bond yields, maybe a strong recession signal potentially. Gold breaking out potentially is the signal of trouble in the economy. But until this trade issue came up, it seemed like the stock market was just immune to almost every other signal. As soon as the trade issue hit the radar screen, stocks took a nosedive, but already they're starting to recover. So does this mean that if you're correct and President Trump is just using a negotiating tactic here, that eventually stocks continue moving back to new all-time highs? Or does the stock market take a cue from the bond market at some point?
I completely agree that something does not compute. It is impossible that the message that we receive from the bond market is the same one that we receive from the equity market, which is the opposite. So the bond market, more than $15 trillion of negative yield in bonds, is telling us a very high risk of disinflation, not deflation, and a very high risk of stagnation, very, very clearly. The equity market is telling us there's going to be QE no matter what. And as such, it seems that the equity market is discounting that, yes, the macro data is poor. Yes, earnings revisions are negative, and the earnings season was not anything to write home about. However, none of that matters because there will be a very significant, and it needs to be very, very significant round of quantitative easing ahead of us. So it's basically a preemptive call on easing. Now, that's very dangerous from two perspectives. The first one is, obviously, there are people out there that say, hey, what the bond market is telling us is wrong and growth will resume, the tariff situation will be resolved, and there is a great opportunity here because we're going to see PMIs bouncing back and we're going to see earnings and growth expectations improving. Remember that was actually behind the idea to buy into the dip in December, that as from June, we would start seeing a strengthening of the global macroeconomic figures and also of the earnings profile of most sectors. Those two things haven't happened. But it's also very dangerous to believe that central banks are going to take such an aggressive stance simply to maintain the trend of asset valuations. Because central banks absolutely do care about asset prices. However, they don't necessarily react in a way in which investors would expect in terms of timing. They tend to react, as we have seen, for example, in the United States, etc. They tend to react more according to what they see that other central banks are going to do rather than what asset prices are doing, the way that asset prices are fluctuating. So I think that what the market has used the latest headlines on trade wars as an excuse to sell off an already very expensive market. And obviously, what happens in that environment is that the marginal buyer is more scarce because it's more difficult to find somebody that's going to find value even after a correction. The problem here is, okay, what are we discounting in terms of monetary policy is already a very significant easing from the European Central Bank. I think that that was widely discounted after Ms. Lagarde's appointment and the latest conference from Mr. Draghi. What are we discounting as well? That the PBOC will continue to ease and support its financial sector via increasing money supply, and that the Federal Reserve will continue to cut rates, maybe even unwind quantitative tightening. That is already in the market. So what we are really betting, if we go into more into the more cyclical, the higher beta part of the equity market, if we buy into that, what we are actually buying into is something that is very, very difficult, because if a 20 trillion QE stimulus in total that we have seen was not enough, you cannot expect central banks to go out and say, oh, it's going to be 40 trillion now. It's going to be very, very difficult to please an equity market that is already investing aggressively into the most cyclical part of the economy when the signals on that cyclical part of the economy have nothing to do with the trade wars, have everything to do to with the excess of demand side policies. So the reason why PMIs are weakening, the reason why copper is weakening, the reason why oil prices, despite massive supply intervention, are not rising as much as OPEC would like to, etc. All of that is telling you that there is too much overcapacity in the economy, too much slack. That is because not as a consequence of lack of stimuli.
I'd like to expand this discussion of what monetary policy is being discounted, and perhaps how that discounting may be mispriced, in my opinion. It seems to me that although modern monetary theory, MMT, is not a new idea, what is new is the way it's been politicalized. Suddenly, we have presidential candidates talking about how it's going to be possible to give away free college tuition and forgive student loans, and MMT is going to make it all happen. So suddenly, there is a social component where it used to be just economists and market geeks who were interested in monetary policy. It's being politicized, and it makes me wonder whether we're headed toward an environment where politicians try to assert more control over the Fed. And certainly one of the things that has been suggested, you know, a question that came up is will Jay Powell be the last chairman of the Federal Reserve if President Trump actually gets serious about what so far have been seemingly idle threats about trying to abolish the Fed? Are these things that we should be worrying about, or are these things that are going to affect where monetary policy really goes in coming months and years?
I think we should be very worried. I think we should be very worried because there's this feeling amongst politicians that there is no wrong that they can do in terms of monetary policy. QE embedded a view amongst politicians that you can print as much money as you want and nothing is going to happen. And that the economy grows, there's no inflation, unemployment is low, everything is great. However, that was not enough. So why don't we do three times more and printing Argentina style? Because we can. This is the mistake. The mistake is to think that bad effects or that the negative implications of quantitative easing will be offset or improved by more of the same. No? And there's a very important factor here, is that monetary policy and the Federal Reserve's monetary policy has always been driven by one factor more important than inflation or unemployment. The number one factor is global demand for U.S. dollars. The reason why the Federal Reserve can undertake the policies that it undertakes is because it is the world reserve currency, and because commodities are paid in dollars, and because we all use dollars when we travel to exotic places, etc., that's fine. Now, being the world reserve currency is not something that is granted, let alone something that lasts forever. Therefore, if the government in the United States doesn't have as a pillar of its policy that the U.S. dollar remains the world reserve currency, it can unleash all of the negatives that modern monetary theory, when applied in countries as we have seen in Venezuela or in Argentina or in any country in which they decided that they can print all the money that they want and nothing will happen, and it does, is very, very dangerous. So I think that there needs to be a process of education that starts from telling people that the mistakes of printing money and lowering rates are not solved by printing more money and destroying the price and the quantity of money. That is very simple. And it's very complicated because it's very easy to believe that 2 plus 2 equals 22 if you're a politician. But it's not true. And the problem of modern monetary theory is that it only works in paper. You know, the people say, oh, you know, you print all the money that you want, and if there's excess inflation, you tax away the excess money. Isn't that beautiful? Nobody thought about it in the past, because it doesn't work like that. Money creation is not neutral. Money creation disproportionately benefits the first recipient of money, be it the financial system, in the case of quantitative easing, asset prices go up, etc., be it government. And the last recipients of money are always the most negatively affected. Those are salaries and savings. And those are the ones that are going to be obliterated. So that's what people need to understand, is that expansionary monetary policy, the way that it is presented, is not something that has a social component. It is actually the most anti-social policy that one can undertake. What everybody understands, that quantitative easing disproportionately helped the 1% richest part of the population, needs to be translated to what modern monetary theory is, which is to disproportionately benefit the 0.00001% of the population that is actually in government and doesn't suffer from inflationary pressures.
Professor Lacaille, you've just given an extremely credible, and in my opinion, explanation of why 2 plus 2 doesn't really equal 22, and why MMT doesn't really have the promise that a lot of people would like to believe. But if I put myself in the shoes of the average millennial who's not expert in financial markets, Professor Lacaille just said a whole bunch of confusing stuff I didn't understand, and Bernie Sanders told me that I can have my college tuition for free and my past student loans forgiven thanks to something that some other PhD said would work. I like that better. So let's assume that the political process leads us down a path that you and I strongly agree is not prudent and doesn't make sense. But I have the sense you probably also agree with me that there's a very good chance that we're going to go down that path anyway, because if you tell people they can get free stuff and it doesn't cost anything, they're going to take the free stuff. And the politicians that are selling that message are going to be empowered to override cooler heads like yours and mine in the monetary policy process. What are the consequences? What does it mean for markets and for the world if all of your very well-spoken cautions are ignored and instead we just go and monetize in order to give away free stuff?
Well, what I would say to that millennial is a very simple question. What do you prefer to work for? A strong or a weak currency? Very simple question. And the answer, obviously, is a strong currency. No one will tell you, I want to work for a weak currency, because they know that their salary purchasing power falls, and they know that their savings are destroyed. So that's the first part. The second part is, what do you do as a millennial, as somebody who earns a wage, as somebody who's going to start making a living, if you receive a salary in a currency that you know, that you are completely sure that the government will continue to depreciate as much as it can in order to sustain all those allegedly free services that are paid with newly created money? What do you do with your salary? You go out and you buy anything that will maintain the purchasing power of your salary. You will buy gold, you will buy, I don't know, cryptocurrencies, you will buy anything except keeping that currency that is burning in your hands or in your pocket. You would do what the very intelligent Argentine citizens that are trapped in the monetary monster that Argentina is do, which is to escape as quickly as possible from a government that is going to destroy the purchasing power of your salary with the excuse of an alleged social policy. And what happens then is that everybody does what you would do. Of course they do, because they're not stupid. And if everybody does what you do, the government prints a lot more money than what is demanded. Not only that is demanded, the demand of that currency is actually diminishing while the government prints more in order to continuously finance those allegedly free services. What ends up happening is that the inflationary process and the destruction of the real economy is extremely evident. The first thing is because the one thing that you don't do with your salary is invest. Why don't you invest for the future? The reason why you don't invest for the future is because you know that the returns of your investment, if you succeed, will be absolutely absorbed by the government in its monetary destruction. The second reason is because you have absolutely no clue about the future in something that it already has a tremendous level of uncertainty, which is investment. That is why in countries like Argentina, in countries like Venezuela, when they start that process, it becomes a downward spiral, because the first people that are undertaking capital flights out of the country are their own citizens. The second is that real investment collapses, because there is no way that anybody is going to undertake really long-term investments into the economy. The third thing that happens is that those services that were supposed to be given for free actually don't appear, because the currency becomes more and more worthless. And by becoming more worthless, the government does not even get close to offering those kinds of goods and services. What the millennial should understand is that there is no public sector without a thriving private sector. A millennial needs to understand that, needs to repeat that every day until it sinks in. There is no public sector without a thriving private sector. If the public sector continuously erodes and crowds out the private sector, it ends up destroying not just the private sector, but also the public goods and services that it promises to deliver.
Well, we've just done a very thorough job of describing the backstory that might explain some of this disparity between the message we're getting from the bond market and the message we're getting from the stock market. But let's move on now and talk about the bond market and the stock market. What are your outlooks for both? Let's start with stocks. Given all of these conflicting signals, what happens next?
I think that what will likely happen next is that we will see a relief bounce from three factors. One, that China's devaluation, as we saw in the three previous ones, that China's devaluation is sort of absorbed by the market, and it doesn't get any more aggressive, because China needs to maintain on one side an artificially high currency and on the other side an artificially weak currency. In one side, to avoid capital flights and to maintain the purchasing power of salaries and wages, and on the other side, to try to export more. So it's a very delicate balance that they try to manage. So the first one is going to be relief post-devaluation. The second one, in my opinion, is that because we have seen such an aggressive and quick slump in PMIs and in the macro data, much more aggressive than I actually expected in the first half of the year, the signs of stabilization will be seen as positives, very likely. You will see like suddenly we saw today with Germany, oh my gosh, factory orders are up 2%, still down on the year, doesn't matter. But, you know, it's like a certain relief. The third, obviously, is here comes the ECB. The European Central Bank is going to come up with very aggressive messages, like it did in 2009, of stimulus plan, infrastructure, helping through monetary policy, fiscal policy. The European Commission might start to put ideas about a very large stimulus plan, like the ones that we have seen in the past. So we are likely to see a little bit of, let's say, tailwind coming from relief. And I'm sure that we will hear some mild messages coming from the United States and from China about the trade war. Now, what we need to do is to take those with a pinch of salt. And what we need to do is to take those with a pinch of salt, because we have seen all of this in the past and we cannot fall into the same trap again. We have already seen the Juncker plan. We have already seen the growth plan for Europe. We have already seen the massive QE from the ECB. We have already seen the ongoing messages about it's coming, the Peter and the Wolf message about the trade dispute. So we need to take that bounce and reduce exposure to cyclicals. We need to reduce exposure to cyclicals. Absolutely. Bond market. When every single central bank in the world is telling you that they will do anything and whatever it takes so that governments finance themselves cheaply, even at negative rates, that happens, and it happens big time. And we think that we cannot see any more of negative rates. Oh my God, we can. Oh my God, we can. And we were talking before about the what academics say. No, we are seeing so many papers out there saying how to make negative rates work this time. Paper by the IMF that I recommend everybody to read and not to take very seriously, et cetera, et cetera. We are reading so much about the great idea about negative rates that they will be implemented further. Because there's no government in the Eurozone, and there's absolutely no contender to the government or in government in Japan that is questioning negative rates. So we will likely see that getting worse before it worse in terms of negative rates. But as a bondholder, as an investor in bonds, obviously the dichotomy is going to exacerbate that, as we have seen in the last 6 months, I believe.
Now, just a few months ago, a lot of people were still saying, look, that one spot 34, I believe, was the low print on the U.S. 10-year, has to be the final end to the bond bull market. It's all over. It's going the other direction. Well, we're back to within, what, 30 basis points as we're speaking today of that? So are we headed to new lows in yield, new highs in bond prices on the U.S. Treasury?
I think we're going to new lows in yield. And the reason is that as all these things that we have been talking about so far unravel, there is a message that is floating in all of these policies all the time, which is buy dollar assets, which is what central banks are going to be doing. If the European Central Bank enters into a massive printing process, is the collateral for many of the banks that are going to be in the Eurozone defending themselves against negative rates is dollar assets, is treasuries. That's why China has been reducing its holdings of treasuries and yields have fallen. So it is very, very likely that if we go from financial repression to outright QQE Japanese style, then it is very, very likely as well that yields in the U.S. are challenged beyond our expectations.
As crazy as this whole notion of negative yielding bonds seems, I'm able to reconcile it. It's crazy, but if you think about it, you sort of say, okay, so it's really the banking system is not using sovereign bonds as an investment that they're expecting to make money from. They're really using it as a liquidity tool in their balance sheet. The Basel III Accords have some implications. There's reasons for banks to be holding these negative yielding assets. It seems crazy to us, but I can justify it, or at least I can explain it if I struggle. The thing that I cannot understand, and you're a professor of global economics, so please enlighten me. How is it possible in Europe that we now have a couple of dozen negative yielding junk bond issues. And just to refresh our listeners' memory, what a junk bond is when a ratings agency who is expert in these matters looks at the creditworthiness of a borrower and says, you know, this is not a very good risk. This is a really risky investment. These are not the right people to loan money to. Why would someone loan them money? And you can't say it's just because of balance sheet requirements of central banks, so forth. You know, junk bonds are not reserve assets. This has to be a bid that is coming from a free-willed private sector investor somewhere who thinks it's a good idea to bid the price of junk bonds up to a level that it has a negative yield. How does that reconcile with rational expectations theory? It doesn't seem rational at all to me that someone would buy that bond.
I don't think it is rational. I completely agree. I can understand the logic, but it's, again, a very, very dangerous bet. This is the bet, in my opinion. Okay, so if I buy the high-quality assets, they're too expensive, and the yield is already too low and negative. So if I want to search for yield, I need to find something that is, at the same time, gives me a little bit of yield, but at the same time is extremely risky. Why am I going into buying something that is extremely risky and at the same time has a negative yield? Because my bet, maybe conscious or unconsciously, is when the governments and the central bank in the Eurozone have one single policy that is, we will take zombification of the economy, no problem whatsoever. Nobody's worried about that. We will take zombification of the economy, but we will not let anybody fall. I want to go into the riskiest asset. That is the problem. You see, the flawed logic is that while governments are willing to do anything, while governments and central banks are willing to do whatever it takes so that any process of change of economic cycle doesn't come back with the logic of any economic cycle, which is creative destruction, which some businesses fail, others thrive, etc. When you're taking the first part of the equation out, which is nothing can fail, then you want to move into the riskiest assets because those are the ones that rise in price the most, while the yield is negative in any case. It's a very, very dangerous bet. It's like basically saying, because I have almost a safe bet in the fact that if I buy a sovereign bond, it will be repurchased by the central bank, and therefore I may not make any money, but I'm sort of maintaining the value of my assets. I'm going to go not three, but four steps further as an investor. And I'm going to go for the riskiest asset because if I and the rest of the wave make that asset systemic, then it has to be bailed out. You see, it's a process. This is the collateral damage of quantitative easing, is that quantitative easing and expansionary monetary policies lead consciously or unconsciously investors to take a view that it is best to take more risk because in one way or another, that extreme risk will be rewarded with a bailout, with some form of bailout. It can be an indirect or a direct bailout. Now, think about it. If the ECB is going to make a massive QE that has to give a message to the market that is going to be bigger, bolder, and more aggressive than the previous one, we're talking how much? 5 trillion, 6 trillion euros? So that investor is thinking, you know, my bonds of this company that cannot pay its interest expense with operating profits and is barely at the edge of bankruptcy, these are gold dust. Because of the previous, because if the ECB says 5 trillion, where is it going to get it from? It's not going to get it from blue chip investment grade issuances because it doesn't even start. It doesn't even get it from financing all the deficits of the peripheral economies and because that's already happening. So where's it going to get it from? You see, it's a massive bet on an indirect bailout of the zombification of the economy.
Let's move on as we talk about all of these bailouts and things that, surely have to end badly someday. Let's talk about gold, which, despite the strength of the U.S. dollar that I thought was going to be a headwind for gold, we've seen a breakout above a very important technical level at 1350 to 1377, which has held for 5 years now. Not only did we break above that level, but we moved about $200 almost above the 1350 initial breakout zone in a couple of months. What is this telling us? And it's not coupled. At the same time, you know, we're not seeing the dollar dump here. We're seeing the dollar very much hold its own. And for a while, the dollar was breaking out until President Trump started, you know, talking about trade wars. The dollar was breaking out at the same time that gold was breaking out. So what's going on? What does this change in correlation between the dollar and gold mean? And is this the beginning of a really, really big move up in gold?
Well, on one side, in gold, the fundamentals of gold have improved quite a lot. Central bank buying of gold is at all-time highs. So on one side, the supply-demand scenario is pretty good, and that sort of maintains a minimum price. The second one is that if people start talking of currency wars, they start to think immediately, what is the reserve of value here that I can look for? Now, the reason why gold and the dollar were rising at the same time as Bitcoin, and while copper was coming not down, but sort of, you know, doing nothing, was because what ended up happening, which was a devaluation of the yuan, was already quite predicted by the many Chinese citizens. And if you think about what has been going on in terms of gold buying and in terms of dollar assets buying, a lot of it has come from Chinese banks and Chinese citizens. So I think that that's why there was this correlation. You know, it was basically a negative yuan, positive any reserve value option. Now, what can we expect for the future? If we enter, you know, let's start from my premise. I don't think it is easy, even politically beneficial, to enter a currency war. So if we don't enter a currency war, then it is quite possible that gold, which is an inflation hedge as well, gold gets a correction, but then continues its slow way up that is more driven by monetary insanity than anything else. But if remember that gold tends to get sold off when markets perceive, oh, there's not going to be an inflation burst, B, there's not going to be a currency war. So that could happen. There could be a correction because of that effect that I was talking about before, the relief that things are not getting worse than what the market is already discounting. But I think that if we enter a currency war, and again, we cannot do anything else but guess, but if we enter a currency war and central banks not only start increasing money supply, but actively targeting the currency, then obviously gold is going to rise significantly. So what we need to pay attention is not to the messages. The messages are going to be the same as always. Central banks will absolutely deny any intention to manipulate the currency. Absolutely, they will. What we need to do is to pay attention to the actions. And if the actions can be directly related to an active decision to influence the currency, not an indirect one. QE is an indirect sort of hope for that the currency will weaken as a secondary effect. That is not what I'm talking about. What I'm talking about is actively selling reserves, etc. No? So that's what we need to pay attention to, because that is what will probably kick the price of gold above its resistance level.
Let's move on to emerging markets. You told us in the last interview that they still had a long way to go before finding a bottom. What's your current outlook?
I believe that what we're going to see in the next 12 to 18 months is the effect of all the dollar-denominated maturities that are coming to be repaid. No? So there's pressure to buy dollars, and there is pressure as well to refinance in an environment that in which you have more risk attached to growth expectations than what we had last year, in which there was a sort of expectation that things would bounce into the second half. So I would be very cautious about emerging markets, particularly because in many cases, as we're seeing with India, as we're seeing with Argentina, as we're seeing with Turkey, in many cases, they don't have tools to defend the currency. And the currency itself is the only sort of valve that allows them to try to at least disguise the effects of the imbalances that they have built in foreign currency in the last 8 years.
Well, I can't thank you enough for a fantastic interview, Professor Lakai. Before I let you go, please tell our listeners, I believe you write a blog, and for our accredited investors, you also manage a fund for Tresis. Please tell us how they can contact you to get more information.
Thank you so much. Yes, if you want to follow me, the blog is dlacalle.com. That is dlacalle.com. You have it in Spanish and in English, so impossible to avoid getting my opinions. Also on Twitter and on LinkedIn, etc. Not difficult to find me. I'm also the author of 3 books, Life in the Financial Markets, The Energy World is Flat, and Escape from the Central Bank Trap. And I'm proud to say that I will be publishing a new one in March 2020. It's called Freedom or Equality. The fund is called Adriza Global. And you can find more information on the website of Tresis, T-R-E-S-S-I-S.
Well, thank you so much for another fantastic interview. We look forward to getting you back on the show sometime around when that next book comes out. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, what a great interview with Daniel Lacalle. He's always got some great perspectives on just how everything is developing, and especially his insights into what's happening in Europe were pretty interesting.
Yeah, he's based in Europe and he has excellent insights. I think he's a really brilliant macro analyst overall. Speaking of brilliant analysts, though, Patrick, I want to give you credit. You called me this morning and said, hey, GE. And I said, I know, it's on the news. But then you connected a few dots that I didn't see right away. The news, for anyone who hasn't heard it, is that Harry Markopoulos, the same whistleblower who blew the whistle on Bernie Madoff back whenever that was, 2007 or so, that same guy has basically accused GE of Enron-scale accounting fraud. Now, Patrick, you immediately connected the dots and said, wait a minute, Louis Vincent Gav told us that GE was the whale of the BBB credit market in a conversation which was about what were the triggers or catalysts that might lead to a much larger disruption in credit markets. Now, as I look at the market reaction, GE stock took an absolute nosedive on this. But as far as anybody making the same connections that you made and anticipating that this could lead to a major dislocation in BBB and junk-rated credit generally, the market hasn't figured that out yet. And of course, it's just speculation on our part. But I think it's very worth going over. So you put a chart deck together. Listeners, you'll find Patrick's chart deck linked in your Research Roundup email. It says post-game chart book. If you don't have Research Roundup email, that means you haven't registered yet. Shame, shame. Just go to macrovoices.com on our homepage. Look for the red button next to Professor Lacalle's picture that says looking for the downloads. Patrick, let's dive into this chart book. Tell us what you've got here and give us the story.
Right. On page 2, all I have is the just a snapshot from CNBC's headline, just talking about some of the key points, which is that Harry and his team were basically analyzing for 7 months, thoroughly going through all of GE's accounting, and believe that there's a $38 $1 billion with a B fraud. And more importantly, he says that it's merely the tip of the iceberg. And I thought that was amazing when I hear, like, okay, I thought $38 billion is a lot, but he thinks that there is more. And he says that this could be a bigger fraud than Enron. And the first thing that came to mind, and by the way, anyone that's interested, we included a link in the roundup to a website that they put up, which is the GEfraud.com. And also on page 3 have the screenshot of that website. And so they're really going all in on this idea that there's something going on. And the first thing that came to mind was that we're always looking for a catalyst, some canary in the coal mine that sets in motion a series of events that lead to ultimately a bigger unraveling. And I, to use an analogy, I was thinking, like, is this like an earthquake in the middle of the ocean that just triggered a tsunami, that when you're sitting on the shore of the beach, you don't really see that there's this big wave of water coming at you until it actually reaches you. And that made me immediately think back to when we had both Professor Edward Altman and Louis Vincent Gav on our mid-December 2018 Macro Voices episode, where we talked about junk bonds and credit risks. And Louis, give him credit, he nailed this one. So what I did on pages 6, 7, and 8 is I just took excerpts out of Louis Vincent Gav's chart book, where he basically gave the analogy of dynamite fishing. And he's saying, you know, they throw the dynamite in and a bunch of these fish come floating up. But it takes a while, you know, sometimes you kill a whale and it takes a while for the whale to float up to the top. And you only after the fact find out. And he kind of using that same that idea and was asking the question back in December, is General Electric that whale for the high yield bond market? Now, what happened at the end of the year when the markets bottomed, GE started to rebound. And over the last 6-7 months, everything seemed rather calm and everything seemed to stabilize. But clearly, this bombshell of the fact that there could be a massive accounting fraud. I mean, everyone's looking at what it's doing to the share price, which was obviously a 10%+ haircut in very short order. But the question is, will this now open up the idea that the rating agencies are going to now use this information to really assess whether or not General Electric debt and all of its money markets and everything need to get downgraded to high yield or junk status, and the implications that that would have? You know, I have that chart on page 8 where Louis Vincent Gao was showing the size of that triple B market versus the size of the junk bond or high yield market. And GE's debt is like $100+ billion of this debt. And if this downgrade happened, what impact would that have?
Patrick, I think we need to put something in perspective before we go on. I agree with you that I like your analogies, and I think we need to think about whether there's a tidal wave that's below the surface that hasn't hit the shore yet. But before we go there, we need to put some things in perspective. When Harry Markopoulos exposed Bernie Madoff as being a fraud back in the early 2000s, at that time, he was acting as a concerned citizen, a smart guy who's very good at forensic accounting, and didn't really have any financial motive associated with what he was doing. He didn't make any money from exposing Bernie Madoff. He is now working with an unnamed short-selling hedge fund on this project. So there is a financial incentive for Harry Markopoulos and the people that he's working with to want to see GE fail here. And we just need to keep that in perspective. It does not change my view that I think he's onto something that could be very real and could have very serious consequences. But we do need to keep this in perspective and realize that the people that are in this game are big boys that are playing for big bucks, and they have motives that we need to consider. Having said that, I think you've got exactly the right analogy, Patrick. And just to refresh our listeners' memory, the reason that GE is so relevant is that triple B rated bonds in general are the last grade of investment quality bonds. If they get downgraded just one rung from there, they're no longer investment grade. And that doesn't mean that some people will feel inclined to sell them. It means that institutional holders will be required to sell them by mandate. And if that happens, we could see a really major dislocation in credit markets. And I think it could spread contagion into the junk bond market as well. So the question is, has the triple B rated tranche of investment grade credit, that's the lowest rated investment grade credit, is it actually junk in disguise that we just didn't know was junk? And are we just starting to find out that, hey, junk really does mean junk? Now, until now, what's been going on is bond yields have been plunging, is that the value of junk bonds has been just going to the moon. They're moving in sympathy with treasuries, as if that additional credit risk that's represented by their lower credit rating didn't matter. What if it's about to start mattering and start mattering a whole lot? That's the real question. So far, in today's market action, that's not being discounted. If it is being discounted next week, we're definitely taking credit and saying Macro Voices is where it all started. But the question is, what happens next? And we have to remember, too, it could be that the people that Markopoulos is working with are frauds, and they've been playing him in order to use his name, in order to do some sleazy short sale deal, and then maybe GE did nothing wrong. Frankly, if I had to flip a coin, I would guess that there's something very real here, and I think that you're right, that it could be the catalyst to start a major dislocation in credit markets, if it's real.
Right, and so this is where I wanted to move on and actually talk about where investment-grade bonds and high-yield bonds are trading by just looking at the ETFs that represent them, right? So on page 10, we have the chart for the investment-grade bond ETF, the LQD. And when we're looking at this chart, I find it fascinating, this beautiful uptrend that investment-grade corporate bonds have been in. And really, I guess the best way to describe it is that as interest rates have been collapsing on government debt, that has basically caused almost all bond proxies and corporate bonds and everything to rise as the structural interest rates are going down. And so we've had this enormous rally. And what you can see on page 11 is I show the credit spreads of the triple Bs over that of Treasury. And what we can see here is that the credit spreads have actually been rather narrow. In other words, all that's been happening is that these investment grade bonds have been more or less moving in lockstep with treasuries on the upside. And this is a beautiful bond market rally occurring. But we now are continuing to hear more and more people voice their concerns with yield curve inversions and all of this, that U.S. recession is imminent. And one thing that we have seen is that whether it's an economic slowdown or an outright recession, that it tends to put stress onto corporates, whether or not investment grade or junk, which usually causes that credit spread to widen. As an example, in 2016, even though we never saw a U.S. recession officially, the credit spreads blew out all the way to 300 basis points back then. And so here we are trading at 165 basis points, potentially, you know, a stone's throw away from a potential recession, and these credit spreads have not begun even to widen.
Patrick, going back to slide 10, we should point out that the LQD ETF represents investment-grade bonds generally, not just triple Bs. Probably about half of the contents of LQD are triple B. The others are higher rated. So it's not quite apples to apples there. But what we can see, I think, if you look at slide 10, and then we move on to slide 12, which is junk bonds, the junk bond chart looks much more similar to an S&P 500 stock market chart than it does to that straight up line that we saw on LQD. So there's a little bit of risk being discounted here, but I would say not enough risk. We're still seeing high yield bonds acting as if nothing's wrong. And I think that junk rating is not really being discounted in prices as much as it should be. So what do you think the trade is here? Should we be looking at something like shorting JNK and HYG against a long in treasuries in order to hedge out that risk of even lower interest rates?
Right. Now, the one thing to observe, now I don't know the exact math because I didn't do it, but I've heard a number of people reference the idea that the correlation of the junk bond markets or the HYG is like as much as 80% to equities. So you have a very equity-like component feel to the junk bonds. With that said, the breakdown here is clearly that the high yield looks like it's topping and rolling over. It looks like it's a much more relevant trade here. The problem here is obviously you have to be very careful with your timing. You can't really just short sell and hold the high yield market because you have that huge negative carry of the yield. So you really have to have a confidence that the break is happening now, right? And I think that it's certainly worth exploring going into this period of September, October, which are generally periods where equities do very poorly. If we start seeing that that yields bottom on the broader markets just because they've overshot, then maybe the whole thing starts to sell here. I mean, it's certainly worth exploring a trade. The problem is in the options market, the options are not that liquid. You know, you'll pretty much have to go in there and be aggressive with it if you believe that this move is imminent, right?
Well, and we should mention, too, a lot of people think that from a seasonality standpoint that market crashes happen in October. But actually, Patrick, the real seasonality pattern there is that October is the month you tend to remember because that's when the worst of it happened. But usually those October crashes actually followed a high that occurred in August. And now we are in the second half of August, or we will be in one more day. It's the second half of August, which is when stock markets usually peak before they get into really serious trouble in the fall. So from a seasonality perspective, what we're seeing here would make sense if maybe the big selling is upon us. I think we really need to talk more about the technical levels that you think are important. Where would you throw in the towel and say, okay, look, it's time to say the bear market is really on here. We're not headed back to all-time highs. We've got clear and decisive indications that it's over. Is it a particular price level or some other indication?
Well, on the S&P 500, just the fact that the sell-off that occurred here at the start of August was so deep in its magnitude that it almost wiped out the entire June to July rally, immediately, from a technical perspective, starts to look like a topping formation. Some technicians will want to cookie cutter a head and shoulder style looking pattern on top of there. It's certainly possible. But to me, definitely we've hit some intermediate top. Now, for me, like you were talking about in the market wrap, the fact that the selling almost immediately reversed that up day is telling you that the sellers are not done selling. For me, there's immediate vulnerability for the market to still continue this downwards. Now, a measured move targets down towards about 2,700 on the S&P. And so if we break this 2820 level, really there is still room. There's a pretty good air pocket in there that where we could see the selling drop a solid 100 S&P points in short order. But then it'll be really interesting is if we kind of bounce from those levels back into September, things to calm down. And then we sort of have this around the Fed when we have quadruple witching coming and all sorts of different cross currents, whether that is where the really bigger sell-off may ensue.
Well, Patrick, we're going to be taking a couple of weeks off at a very interesting time. And as much as I've been wrong before saying I think it's finally time for gravity to set in, I won't be the slightest bit surprised if when we come back the first week of September, if we're looking at lower numbers on the S&P. But time will tell. And for those of you who want even more of Patrick's fantastic chart book content, be sure to sign up to attend the Toronto Money Show on September 21st. The All Stars of Options event is being hosted there. Patrick is headlining along with a couple of other speakers. You can find all of the details on page 15 of the chart book, or you can find that information at bigpicturetrading.com. Attendance is free for the All Stars of Options in Toronto. And if you like free stuff, you should also sign up for a free trial of bigpicturetrading.com. All of that information is available on the website. Today's episode of Macro Voices was made possible by Top Traders Unplugged. Don't forget to go to toptradersunplugged.com/macro to claim your free copy of the many flavors of trend following and subscribe to their podcast as well. You'll be glad you did. For information on sponsoring Macro Voices, please go to macrovoices.com/sponsorinfo. And be sure to register your free account at macrovoices.com. The benefit to you is you'll receive our free research roundup email each week, which provides links to all of the best content that we could find on the internet. Patrick, tell them what to expect in this week's research roundup.
Well, this week you're going to find the transcript for today's interview with Daniel, as well as a link to the charts that we discussed about General Electric in the postgame. You'll also find that link to the GE fraud website. There's also a really interesting article discussing Jeffrey Gundlach warning that the Fed cutting rates will not stop a U.S. recession. So you'll find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup. That does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we'll include it in our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at macrovoices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend and myself at Patrick Serezna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com. The Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the Internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.